Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. So I'm going to start with the rest of the article that we started yesterday on stealing from grandma. So we were talking about the fact that it's quite often family members or friends. So let's move on. Multiple watchers are key. Lori believes if enough people are overseeing a person's finances, exploiters will be less likely to attack. And if they do, all will see it. Has the COVID-19 crisis increased elder financial abuse? Studies have revealed that social isolation is a known risk factor. No wonder that Eversafe's customer care unit showed a 30% increase in potential fraud reports in 2020 over 2019. What can be done? To reduce family financial abuse, we simply have to do a better job of watching out for one another, whether it's checking on loved ones more regularly or connecting them to technology that can help detect and prevent wrongdoing. Start by protecting yourself. I have long noted that many of the services that for-fee financial or credit monitoring companies provide can be done on your own. Establish online access to all financial accounts. Monitor those accounts daily. Have everyone in your family, including young children, get credit freezes, order and review free annual credit reports from all three credit bureaus, and so on. Learn these skills now, and you will be able to guard your accounts forevermore. Although if you're just not comfortable navigating technology or don't have the time to keep up with your accounts, it might well be worth looking into a financial monitoring service. Guarding older family members or friends is trickier, given your lack of access to their financial accounts. But you can check in frequently. Encourage them to sign up for such a service. Talk often with caregivers. Even offer yourself as a trusted advocate. You can also pay for a monitoring service yourself if that gives you peace of mind. If we don't make such a commitment, we all risk being visited by exploiters one day. Some obvious and even easy to spot, but others dressed in sheep's clothing. Now, since we're talking about finances, let's do the next one, doing the math on an annuity. The economy makes one woman nervous, so should she dump this investment? Jean Chatsky to the rescue. The problem is, about a decade ago, Michelle Manna brought an investment that she didn't understand. Guided by her financial advisor, she put $50,000, about a sixth of her retirement stash, into a variable annuity. Manna, now 65 and retired, receives about $4,100 a year in income from it. But, scared about the economy, she was thinking of cashing out. Would it be wise for me to liquidate, she wrote, or should I keep the funds in the market even though I don't feel safe? Here's the advice. In theory, the pain of a market decline can be eased by a variable annuity, an insurance product that combines investments with the possibility of guaranteed lifetime income. The value of those investments can rise and fall with the market. But the money that Manna can receive as an annual lifetime benefit is governed by a separate value, her benefit base, which was guaranteed to grow at least a little each year, even if the value of her investments fell. If Manna cashed out her annuity, it's doubtful she could replace her $4,100 annual lifetime income, which is calculated from her $82,000 benefit base. That's because she had received only the value of her investments, now around $67,000. If she put that into certificates of deposit, a likely choice given her quest for safety, and spent $4,100 annually, she would run through the money in 17 years or so. It helps to think about a variable annuity as having two different life stages, the accumulation phase and the payout phase, says Steve Vernon, a consulting research scholar at the Stanford Center on Longevity. Because Manna had already turned on the income stream for her annuity, she should stop thinking of it as an investment, he notes, and instead look at it as a paycheck that will last as long as she lives. The outcome? After I first spoke with Manna, but before I got back to her with my advice, she decided to cash out part of her annuity. From the $67,000 in investments, she took $20,000, some of which she might use for a building assessment. Once we reconnected and spoke, she was willing to leave the rest of the money in place. It now generates a guaranteed annual payout of about $3,000. Looking at her variable annuity as income, not an investment, makes sense to her. That's information that in the 10 years I've owned the annuity, my broker never made clear to me, she said. Knowing that it's secure makes me feel a lot better. Now I'm going to read the next essay from 80 Things to Do When You Turn 80. My Life, an Audacious Adventure. This is by Fred Weinberg. He was born and raised in Paterson, New Jersey. Nancy Helmick got it right in her article, How to Find Your Passion After You're Retired, featured in the October 15, 2014 issue of USA Today. Take Fred Weinberg of New York City, she wrote, who retired at age 55 in 1988 after working almost three decades as a New York State patrol officer. Since then, Weinberg is now 81 and has had half a dozen different careers. He volunteers one day a week at the pediatric social work department at a hospital in New York. My dad died in his mid-50s. I never expected I would make it much beyond, let alone into my ninth decade. I wasn't conscious of my compulsive need to make every day count until I heard myself telling Helmick how important it was for me to stay active and be prepared for the physical adjustments and restructuring that define the aging process. So instead of accepting the premise that 80 was old, I would flaunt it. Why not? How often was my ego assuaged hearing, gee, you don't look that old? The idea of retirement was anathema to me, and I came across as somewhat of a bore with my haughty attitude. On more than one occasion, I was called to task by retired friends for bragging about my latest job. The insinuation was, of course, look at me, I'm still capable of working. I needed to believe that I could still compete in the job market, and it became a challenge. It was a game I was now playing. Could I still convince a prospective employer I would be a good fit for the job, my age notwithstanding? 2 years ago, that plan backfired after I resigned from a very desirable part-time job in a hospital social work department to accept a job that turned out to be a bad match. I resigned at the end of the first day. Once I was able to step away from that situation, I realized I faked my way through the pre-employment process. I obviously wasn't at peace with myself. What was it I was looking for? Then something happened when I turned 83 earlier this year. For the first time since my mid-20s, I found myself not working. Instead, I'm volunteering at the hospital and taking classes in an adult education program 3 days a week. I recently self-published a memoir, Social Workers with Guns, an account of my 30-year career with the New York State Division of Parole. I'm a part-time caregiver for Fran, my wife of 32 years, who is bravely dealing with Parkinson's disease. Besides lots of reading, attending concerts and movies, and writing, I maintain close ties to my three daughters and two grandchildren, and hopefully I'm finally breaking free of that uncanny and irrational obsessive need to prove myself. I believe that having reached my ninth decade is a blessing, and as the days now seem to pass so swiftly, I'm aware how important it is to make every day count. I've set a goal for myself of accomplishing something positive each day, no matter how insignificant. Time is short. I'm now in Act 3, and this is not a dress rehearsal. And now, let's explore understanding Alzheimer's and your guide to brain health. This first article is a bit lengthy, and I'll probably continue it next time. Chapter 1, Inside Your Brain. People are living longer now than they ever have. In 2015, fewer than 1 in 10 people in the world was over the age of 65. By 2050, this number is expected to almost double. As the population ages, it's not surprising then that the number of people living with dementia is expected to increase. Dementia is an age-related disease, and by some estimates, individuals with the disease could triple by 2015. The term dementia describes a group of symptoms affecting memory, thinking, and social abilities that can interfere with daily living. Dementia isn't a specific disease. Several different diseases may cause dementia. And there are many forms of dementia. The one you've likely heard most about is Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause of progressive dementia in older adults. Knowing that Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia are expected to increase, you may wonder if there's anything that you can do to prevent dementia. It's a common question without an easy answer. Certain risk factors for dementia, such as old age, family history, can't be changed. But there are steps that you can take to stay healthy as you grow older and lessen your chances of disease. Many of the strategies for living well as you age are ones you've likely heard many times. Getting regular physical activity, following a healthy diet, not smoking, managing stress, and getting good quality sleep are all ingredients for a long and healthy life. But what about strategies specific to brain health? Are there ways you can lower your risk of dementia? Better yet, can dementia be prevented entirely? If you have dementia, what can be done to treat it or slow its progression? Can you live well with dementia? If so, how? These are important questions that scientists and researchers are seeking to answer. In the chapters ahead, we will explain what medical professionals know and what they're yet hoping to discover when it comes to brain health and dementia. We begin with a discussion of what's typical in aging and what's not. You'll also learn about the parts of the brain specific to memory and other cognitive skills. This information can help you to better understand brain health. What's typical and what's not? No matter how healthy and injury-free you've kept yourself, the wear and tear that comes with age takes a toll on your body. You may start noticing changes as early as your 30s or 40s, when it's a little bit harder to bounce back from a cold or to run as fast as you used to. Some of the physical changes that come with aging are easy to see, such as graying or thinning hair. Your skin is another example. It may wrinkle and sag as it becomes thinner, drier, less elastic. Age spots may appear, and your skin may bruise more easily. Other physical changes that occur over time may not be as easy to spot, at least at first. As you age, your eyes and mouth may start to feel drier. Vigorous exercise gets more difficult because your lungs can't take in as much air when you breathe. The walls of your bladder often become less elastic, making more frequent bathroom trips necessary. And some age-related changes are so subtle that you may not notice them until they're well established. Your digestive system naturally slows down, leading to bouts of constipation. Your immune system doesn't work as well, so you may get sick more often. Kidney function declines, so it's easier to get dehydrated or to retain fluid. These are all typical changes that come with age, changes that many people learn to adapt to in everyday life. So we will continue with this article next time. Now let's go back to AARP, the magazine, and let's look at Michael Douglas at 76. Looking back, looking forward. Teenage Crimes, A Famous Family, 50-some years of Hollywood success. The actor is happy to talk about it all, but mostly he's focused on the possibilities ahead. This article is by Allison Glock. Michael Douglas is curious. Even though he is a commanding presence in virtually any room, what with the enviable hair and that unmistakable gravel rake of a voice, Douglas, 76, makes a point of asking questions, remembering names, noticing the little things, art hung in back corners, the personal style of a guest, or, in this case, Zoom interviewer. It is a natural wonderment and humility that has served him well over his 50-plus years in show business, where his slippery, urbane charm as an actor and his spot-on instincts as a producer have kept him firmly lodged in the Hollywood pantheon to which he was born, as the elder son of Kirk and Diana Douglas. When Michael was a child, though, Kirk's movie success was not assured. "People have this idea that I'm part of show business royalty," Douglas said, before clarifying, "I cherish the relationship I had with my father, and I would love to fill the fantasy. But when I was young, he was a working actor and hadn't quite made it yet." Ultimately acquainted with the fickleness and frailty of the actor's life, Douglas made an early choice not to rely on performance alone, bolstering his career behind the camera by investing in and producing films that have uncannily reflected the societal preoccupations of their era. Notably, 1975's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and 1979's The China Syndrome. He also acted in such cultural harbingers as 1987's Fatal Attraction and Wall Street, and 1995's The American President, and he hosted 2019's Unbreaking America, Divided We Fall. "I'm a news junkie," the Oscar and Emmy winner enthuses, explaining how he has stayed attuned to what's going on. "And I've got the common touch. I know what most people feel about stuff." Douglas is currently tapping into this moment's devastating malaise view via his poignant Netflix comedy, The Kominsky Method, in which he plays an acting coach who is past his prime, grappling with the question of what actually matters in the long run of life. Interrogations the cancer survivor has fully dissected as he has welcomed a second grandchild, prepares to be an empty nester, and his COVID-19 vaccinations pending, at long last leaves the couch. "I've never watched more television than in the last year. It has been a solemn sedentary season, and Douglas is eager to travel again, to work, to embrace his friends, to debate and learn and feed his appetites, which remain as keen and varied as ever. With maturation, you don't necessarily feel a whole lot different from what you felt when you were younger," he says. "I'm just looking for the joy of a good moment." The kid. What words would you use to describe yourself as a child? "Shy, introverted, cautious. I didn't have a lot of confidence. My paternal grandfather was a junk man, an immigrant. He didn't speak English or write or read. My father was one of seven children. He met my mother after college. Dad went into the Navy, and we lived in New York in a one-room apartment in Greenwich Village. My father was a very intense guy. When he started working in California, those were the days when actors were making 5 movies a year, the marriage fell apart. I know he loved me, but he felt guilty because his father had abandoned his family, and the one thing Kirk never wanted to do was abandon his children, and he felt like he was doing that, so it was sort of awkward and tense. When do you come into your own? It wasn't until my mother remarried, when I was 13, to a lovely guy named Bill. He was the first man who listened to me and the first I gained some confidence with, and Kirk was always very grateful to Bill. Did you have aspirations to act? I was at the University of California at Santa Barbara in 1963, and it was a spectacular time to be out in California. I ended up getting a motorcycle and riding in my velour Renaissance shirts up to San Francisco for rock concerts. Then I got called into the vice chancellor's office. "You've got to declare a major, man." So I thought, okay, theater. I must say that my father, Kirk, came to just about every show I did, as busy as he was, and he told me right in the beginning, "Son, you were awful. You were just awful." He laughs. It seems to have worked out okay. I had terrible stage fright. I don't know why I did not give it up, but I just ground away for about a year and started to get better. What was the worst rule to break in your family? Lying didn't go over too good, even white lies. If you lie, people lose faith in you, and it just makes everything more difficult. So, were you a bit of a straight edge as a young man? Not really. I was into hot rods, tinkering with cars. I worked at a mobile station at one point, and my first real award was Mobile Man of the Month. I also was a member of a group called the Downshifters, a little bit like the Jets in West Side Story. Sings, "When you're a jet all the way." I had a DA, when you'd comb your hair to look like a duck's ass. The DA, we called it. We were known to spend a little time locating automobiles that had parts we wanted. Not proud about it, but it kept me out of a lot of other trouble. What is the most important lesson your father taught you? Whatever you do, make sure you give your best effort and try as hard as you can. After that, F it. The other sections in this article include the actor, the dad, and the future, and we will get to those next time. Now, with the rest of our time, we have time for a few short items. U.S. museums get busy. These are also from AARP, the magazine. Three major openings for your future travel plans. The pandemic has been hard on America's museums, but 2021 brings at least three big debuts. Coming soon, the redesigned Halls of Gems and Minerals at New York City's American Museum of Natural History, and the Loom Indianapolis, which will feature an immersive Van Gogh experience at the Indianapolis Museum of Art Galleries at Newfields. Plus, the National Museum of African American Music recently opened in a 56,000 square foot space in downtown Nashville, Tennessee. Rethinking rooms. The pandemic has changed our perception of home. What's in and what's out? Moving in. Gems. People are no longer content with a weight bench in the basement, says Lee Crowder of Builder Taylor Morrison. Rooms may include TVs for streaming workouts and temperature controls for hot yoga. Zen dens and hearth rooms. These are serene spaces with soft lighting, natural materials, and soothing sound systems. It fits where we are now, notes Devin Schaefer of Decor Aurelia Online Interior Design. Moving out. Mega great rooms. Perhaps no other design element was put under the microscope more in 2020 than the open plan, says Mitchell Parker, a senior editor at the interior design website, Whooz, H-O-U-Z-Z. And guest rooms. People are reinventing these rarely used spaces for everyday use, Schaefer observes. What's in now is flex spaces that can be converted into bedrooms for overnight stays. My home is worth what? Should you take home values on Redfin, Realtor.com, and Zillow seriously? These estimates are based on factors including area sales data, but it's a computer and it can't walk into your home or see its unique features, said Winchester, Massachusetts real estate agent Catherine Waters Clark. So those values may be off. The first thing I'm ready for, notes Portland, Oregon agent Sam Doubtstead, someone says, Zillow says my home is worth this. Often people think their home is worth more than it is. Seeds or plants. How to know which is better for your garden. Gardening expert Tama Wong of Meadows and More offers this spring planting advice. Consider your space. If you don't have much for plant, go for plants. Seeds generally need to be distanced many inches apart to have room to grow. Plants are easier to visualize in your space. Consider the effort. Skip indoor seed starting unless you have 30 to 60 minutes every day for care and can regulate the indoor environment with grow lights, heat mats, and potting mix. Consider the calendar. Seed instructions indicate optimal times to plant based on frost dates if you've missed the window by the plant. Consider the plant's stage. Plugs are starter plants that can often be bought more economically by the tray. Plus, this means that the plants have had less chance to become root-bound in the nursery's pots, which would hinder further growth. And finally, consider easy care plants. Perennials will come back year after year. Also, herbs such as oregano, mint, and lemon balm require little effort. Now, I don't have a source for these last comments. They were sent to me from my friend from Canada. But did you think in 1998 that 3 years later you would never take pictures on film again? With today's smartphones, who even has a camera these days? Yet, digital cameras were invented in 1975. The first ones only had 10,000 pixels, but followed Moore's law that technology capacity will double every year. So, as with all exponential technologies, it was a disappointment for a time before it became way superior and became mainstream only in a few short years. It will now happen again, but much faster, with artificial intelligence, AI, health, autonomous and electric cars, education, 3D printing, agriculture, and jobs. Forget the book, Future Shock. Welcome to the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Software has disrupted and will continue to disrupt most traditional industries in the next 5 to 10 years. Uber is just a software tool. It doesn't own any cars and is now the biggest taxi company in the world. Ask any taxi drivers if they saw that coming. And finally, Airbnb is now the biggest hotel company in the world, although they don't own any properties. Ask Hilton Hotels if they saw that coming. Well, folks, we've run out of time again for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.